Our first case for argument is Teamsters versus Frontier Airlines. Mr. Quant.
Morning, Judge Kane, Judge Posner, Judge Williams. Judge Posner, last time I was in front of you, you more or less stumped me with a parallel evidence rule, one of the low points of my career, and I'm certainly hoping that's not going to happen today.
Lower even today, maybe, right?
I'm here.
It's a challenge.
Your Honors, I'm here representing Frontier Airways and Republic Airlines. I'm sorry, Republic Airways Holdings. Okay, and I actually feel like I'm representing a little more than that because this is a very important case to the airline industry, and my firm represents about 50 airlines, and I've been presenting on this case for many months, and never more importantly than today. Basically, the case, as you all know, and I certainly respect the reputation of this court for being well-informed, this case involves a minority union. I don't mean that in a disparaging sense, but it's objectively established in the record, nobody disputes it, that the Teamsters represent a minority of the entire crafter class of maintenance and related employees that are employed by all the Republic Airlines Holdings subsidiaries. It's actually about 25%. 27% is the exact number in the record.
Are they the only ones that have union representation?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, a key in point is to try to dispel any notion of anti-union or union busting going on in this particular case. Teamsters represent all of the pilots at Republic subsidiaries, all the flight attendants at the Republic subsidiaries, and
but this has to do with mechanics and
strictly the mechanics. Okay, and it just so happens that when Republic acquired Frontier in October of 2009. It happens that the Frontier mechanics are represented by the Teamsters. All of the other Republic subsidiaries do not have any representation. They are non-union. Of course, we all know that's their choice to be non-union. So we have this situation now where what we term is a black hole in the law. And that's what I termed it when I presented before. And we're asking the court's assistance in not circumventing, but circumnavigating this black hole. And what am I talking about? Under the Railway Labor Act, there's no procedure in place that we can force, we as the employer, can force a union like the Teamsters to file an application with the National Mediation Board to clarify its status as the majority representative of the crafter class. Since the 1994 RLEA D.C. Circuit case, that right has been removed. There was a period of time for about 7 years where employers could do that. In this kind of a situation where you've bought a new airline, you're trying to rationally integrate your operations, you could force the issue to determine whether or not the union still represents a majority of the employees. That ceased after the 1994 D.C. Circuit RLEA case. Right now, we have no vehicle available to us to force the issue.
Employees in question, these would be mechanics in Milwaukee?
These mechanics... Well, specifically, no. The mechanics are on a system-wide basis, Your Honor. It involves mechanics in Kansas City, mechanics in Denver, which is where Frontier was based, mechanics in Milwaukee. Actually, Frontier is all over the country, so it's mechanics all over the country. The specific facts in this case emanate from the situation in Milwaukee. The specific facts in this case have to do with the fact that Republic made the decision sometime in early 2010 to transfer what's called the heavy maintenance work that Frontier was doing in Denver to Milwaukee. The heavy maintenance work is scheduled maintenance where they go in and they really fix up the planes on a scheduled basis. It's important work, et cetera. And this is no surprise to Teamsters. They knew this was going to happen. The company talked about it.
With regard to the acquisition, did the union have any say or play in the acquisition?
No, they would not. If they were informed of it in advance, Your Honor. They were the courtesy of being informed in advance. And they don't dispute that that happened. They don't dispute the fact that they're a minority union on a system-wide basis. And the Railway Labor Act deals with a system-wide basis. You don't deal with city by city under the Railway Labor Act.
Well, if RAH hadn't acquired Frontier, these employees would continue to receive the benefit of the collective bargaining agreement, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So why doesn't it make sense to hold an acquiring company to the agreements of the companies it had acquired?
Because they don't have a representative. The Teamsters are not the majority representative of the crafter class, and you can't have a collective bargaining agreement if you don't have a representative. That's the law, and I mean, it makes sense. You can't have a representative. The collective bargaining agreement effectively goes away if the representation goes away. You can't have a collective bargaining agreement.
Well, one of the things the union says is that NMB found for flight attendants that Frontier was a separate carrier and not part of a single transportation system with other RAH airlines. Is there any reason to expect the board would come out differently
in
this class? Why is that?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, very definitely. Of course, you saw from the briefs, I'm sure, Your Honor, that the board makes the determination on a class-by-class basis.
Right.
The Teamsters, ironically, and I don't know if this was clear from the record, but the Teamsters took the position that it was a single transportation system in that case. They agreed with the company that it was a single transportation system, and in fact, just 3 weeks ago, they've now filed another application for the pilot group. I will give you that site since it's available. It's not in the record, but it's a public document on the NMB website. They definitely believe this is a single transportation system. They know it is. So the fact that the NMB ruled in that case that it wasn't on the specific facts at that time back in January of 2010, we believe that would be reversed if the issue was revisited. And I think the Teamsters believe the same thing. They wouldn't have filed to represent the pilots that are not represented by the Teamsters at Frontier.
So do I understand you, Barry, that when all the mechanics, and if it's a single system, the issue which the board should determine at some point, if it's a single system, then the mechanics represented by Frontier, you say, would be about 20%?
25%.
25%, okay.
And actually, the likelihood is, nobody knows what the board would do or how this would all work itself out. If the Teamsters avail themselves of the process that's out there to establish whether they're actually the representative of the employees, if they would go through that process, we don't know how exactly it would come out. But the likelihood is, with that disparity in the numbers, there's a distinct possibility there would never even be an election.
Well, how about this as a compromise position? Suppose we said that you can ignore the collective bargaining agreement, thus forcing them to go to the board. But during that process, when they're going to the board, you would be enjoined from making any changes. In other words, you would be required to recognize the union until the National Mediation Board makes its decision, and they would have to, they're part of the bargain, they would have to go to the board immediately and ask for determination.
Your Honor, that makes perfect logical, reasonable sense. It's not the law. The law out there is that I know that's easy for me to say. You decide what's the law. Your Honor, the case law, it's not the case law.
But there's no case like this, right?
Yes, there are. There are dozens. I don't want to overstate it. There's about a half dozen cases extremely similar. They're cited just as O'Connor's decision in the IBT versus Western Airlines case, Supreme Court case in 1987, lists all the circuit decisions. There's about five of them out there, including the Seventh Circuit.
Yeah, but don't the cases just say that courts can't issue injunctions in representation disputes?
That's right, because they don't have jurisdiction.
I know, they say that. But there's no case like this, right, where you have this paralysis as a result?
Well, actually, no case exactly like this with a paralysis, Your Honor. I agree with that. Delta has the same situation.
The Railway Labor Act that says you can't have an injunction. This is general language in cases. And, of course, in the ordinary case, it makes perfectly good sense. But this leads to a strange paralysis, right? And on the one hand, if you are free simply to ignore, you have an arguable position that's a single system. If we say you can act on that, then the union goes running to the board, which is fine. But there's going to be a 3 or 6 month interval, and I would think the union would be entitled to freeze the status quo during that interval, which would require an injunction. I don't see, since there's nothing in the Railway Labor Act to prevent that, I don't see why that isn't a perfectly appropriate solution.
What happens then if the NMB, National Mediation Board, follows its current directives, its current policy manual, and they say, you know what, we're not going to accept this application, which is called application for investigation of a representation issue. Okay? They say, we're not going to accept it because you're a minority union. You can't make a sufficient showing of interest. Say they only represented 5% instead of 25%, and the NMB applies that criteria. We're not going to accept your application because you're a minority union.
Their argument is that, as Judge Williams would suggest, their argument is there are two separate systems, and they represent, you know, 100% of the relevant. Can't they argue that to the board?
Judge, they won't argue that to the judge. They've already staked themselves out that this is one system. They staked themselves out in that flight attendant case, and they've now staked themselves out again by filing for a single carrier with the pilots. They are staked out that this is a single transportation system. We run the risk under that scenario, Your Honor, of the NMB dismissing the application based on its current rules and policies, and we're right back to where we are right now, back into this no-man's land.
If they dismiss the application on the ground that the Teamsters are a minority union, that would end it. You wouldn't have any obligation to deal with them.
That is a distinct possibility, Your Honor, and we would have to examine that very carefully if it ran that scenario, make sure that we're not violating the law. It's not the problem we'd have there, Your Honor.
Right, it's a mess.
Excuse me?
It's a mess. Mm-hmm. it's a mess. So don't we have to
resolve
it?
Here's a solution.
It, you know?
Yeah, here's a solution.
We should go to Congress.
No. Mm-hmm. No, that is a solution.
That's a mess, too, though.
Yeah, that would be
a bigger mess.
The nice lame duck session coming up, you'll want to, I'm sure they'll want to address this and resolve it.
I would frame the legal issue. I mean, the legal issue is whether or not this court believes that this is a representation dispute or not, that we've raised what is even arguably a representation dispute through these facts and patterns. If so, the case law says that the courts have no jurisdiction. They step aside and things move on from there. And
yeah, problem here is that Section 2 talks about a dispute that arises among a carrier's employees as his representatives. There's no dispute among employees.
That's the RLEA decision,
right.
Actually. Here's the further irony. The situation doesn't come up when you have two unions.
Right.
Because the reason is that the minority union is going to get displaced because majority union is going to file. There's no way that the unorganized majority Republic employees are going to band up together and get 35% of them to file. Yeah, well, why are they going to do it? There's no point for them to do any of that.
So your argument is that it's not a representation dispute, it's a major dispute?
No, it's definitely not a major dispute. Well, it is a representation dispute.
It's a what?
It's a representation dispute. Yes, Your Honor, it is. And according to all those cases that are cited by Justice O'Connor, this fits in the same category. It also fits almost.
But then what is your, if it is a representation dispute, what is your solution?
This court dismisses for lack of jurisdiction, and we move forward.
How do you move forward?
Not sure. You know what I think would happen, Your Honor? What I think would happen was that the record of
status. You just don't deal with them, right?
What would actually happen? It's sort of reported in the record.
You would say they're not majority representative. You can't legally deal with them. And then they'd go to the board. Is that how it works?
I think the way it would actually work, Your Honor, and it's reported in the record, is that the company would meet and confer with the Teamsters. They've already been doing that and say, okay, now we have this ruling. We need to resolve this whole thing, folks. We're not trying to embarrass anybody. We just want to get it resolved. And they actually offered, it's in the record, they offered the Teamsters, offered them neutrality. If they wanted to try to organize all the Republic employees, they offered the Teamsters neutrality as a way of just getting this whole thing resolved. They have a relationship with the Teamsters, with their pilots and their flight attendants. They know that. They're not just going to run in there and throw rocks and stuff at the Teamsters. They're going to try to deal with them and work this out. The legal proposition that we've articulated, I'm about out of time.
No,
and I really ask the court, this is my little, it's not a gimmick, but it's my solution to this whole problem, and I think it makes a lot of sense, is this unclean hands doctrine. I know it sounds kind of phony and weird. Why would you be arguing unclean hands? But there's good law out there. That Toledo Railroad case and this very recent PHI case that we cited in the Fifth Circuit, a district court case. The Toledo Railroad case is actually a Supreme Court case, 1944, amazing facts surrounding Pearl Harbor. In both cases, you've got situations where unions did not take legal action that they didn't have to take, which is, well, one was a union and one was the company. The PHI case was a union and Toledo was the company. In both cases, they exercised their legal rights by not accepting the government's proffer of arbitration at the end of the interminable process that goes along with collective bargaining in this industry. They had a perfect legal right not to accept that proffer, and both courts say that's fine. But by not accepting that proffer, you don't have clean hands within the meaning of the Norris LaGuardia Act, Section 8, and therefore you're not entitled to an injunction. It's the exact same thing here, Your Honor. I draw a strong, I submit there's a strong parallel. The Teamsters do not have to file their application with the NMB.
But how can you, I don't understand the rationale. How can you, that be unclean hands when they don't have to do anything?
That's actually stumped. District Judge Edelman had the same reaction. The case law reads Toledo, Your Honor, it says exactly that. The language in, here's the reason why. The language in Norris LaGuardia is twofold. It says, you don't have clean hands, this is Section 8 of Norris LaGuardia, if you don't make every reasonable effort to settle the dispute, either by negotiation, meaning get together with the company, and we have a factual dispute about who was bargaining in good faith trying to resolve it or not. That's a factual dispute. But here's the second part. Or with the aid of any available government machinery, okay? That's the language that we're citing. There's a case, a 1936 district court case in Georgia that's cited in our brief, the Cole case, that specifically talks about failure to go to the National Mediation Board means you have not exhausted that provision of Norris LaGuardia.
I thought the union union leaders did meet with RAH several times. It turns out they weren't willing to do it. I mean, to change their position with respect to the collective bargaining agreement.
Judge, that's the factual dispute. I'm talking about the legal argument that by not availing themselves of the mechanism, they have unclean hands.
But even on the legal argument, they're still not. I mean, I don't read that language you cited as requiring them to do it, especially when it seems there was no real dispute and it would be against their interests.
It doesn't require them, but they can't come to court to get an injunction if they don't avail themselves of that. That is the Supreme Court's decision in Toledo, and I'm out of time right now. I'd like to reserve some time.
Time? No, it's not to worry about time. I get back to the point. Okay, you want the preliminary injunction dissolved, and that, of course, put a lot of pressure on the union to go to the board. That's what you want. And I think that's fine, except I should think the union would be entitled to the status quo until the board acts. Right?
No, because there's no jurisdiction to enjoin.
Power, I mean, but there isn't actually any case that says that, and there's nothing in the statute. So I don't know why.
Oh, there's nothing dealing with these precise set of facts. Obviously, there's not. But
okay, well, we'll let you. Ms. Robbins?
Good morning, Your Honors. I think I'd like to begin with the unclean hands issue that Mr. Pont addressed last. And what I would like to point out is that in this case, Mr. Pont is, appellant, is phrasing the situation as a representation dispute.
How is this issue as to whether you're a minority union going to be resolved?
Your Honor, I think that given the words of Section 2, 9...
question. Forget the words of the this or the that. How is
the statute says...
How is it going to be resolved? How is this going to be resolved?
And
are you going to be perpetually recognized, even though you're probably a minority union? Or is there a resolution that can somehow be authorized here?
The resolution must come from an application...
You're not answering my question. My question is if you get your way, will this issue of whether the union is a minority union ever be resolved, or will you simply have perpetual status as the bargaining representative?
I cannot see into the future, Your Honor,
Answer my question, yes or no, and then you can explain your answer.
If I understand your question correctly, it could go on for a long period of time.
It could go on forever. What would terminate it?
Mm-hmm. What would terminate it is an application by a union or
but
a group
no
of employees.
But if no other union comes along and wants to represent these people, then it's never resolved, correct, on your
That's
view.
Right.
Well, that's completely unreasonable, right? Now, maybe the law is that asinine, but it's hard to believe that you can have an illegal union, right?
It's not an illegal union.
Is, no, the statute is explicit. You can't have a minority union. As the collective bargaining, you know, union that represents minority of workers can't be the collective bargaining representative. So there has to be some mechanism for eliminating this illegality. And I suggested one to your opponent, which you go to the board and you ask for a determination. And meanwhile, I'm suggesting, you know, we'll maintain the status quo, so you won't have, you know, there'll be no disruption. You're recognized now. You'll continue to be recognized until and unless the board decides you're a minority union. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is the statute is very clear that disputes...
But is there anything wrong with it as a matter of common sense, equity, or is it just some statutory or...
It is the... Excuse me. It is the statute. The statute says
so in other
that
words,
dispute.
You're acknowledging, or at least you're not disputing, that this is a preposterous result, but somehow we're just trapped by statutory language or language in cases. Is that right? Now, what's
no,
the statutory it is, language?
It is not preposterous. The point is that a union continues once it has certification. Unless there is a dispute
yes,
by
know,
employees as
know,
to who should represent.
The statute is explicit. Minority unions are not allowed to be the collective bargaining representative. But you're saying that as long as there isn't another union who wants to represent these people, there's paralysis. There's no way of resolving the issue.
There is no paralysis. The Alitalia case that we cited in our recent paperwork shows that there are many situations, not just a merger or acquisition, where an employer might think, might even have a very good reason to think, that that union is a minority union. The point is that union was certified for an existing
unit. Yes, but what
unit,
sense does, what sense does this make? That is, you have a union that was certified. Now, suppose it's absolutely clear that it only represents a minority of the workers in the relevant collective bargaining union, so that it is an illegal representative.
It is.
Now, what sense does it make to have no mechanism by which the National Mediation Board can decide whether it is a minority union?
The National Mediation Board has decided that that, in fact, is the best way to handle these things. If you look at the Delta case 36...
Why is it the best way in a situation like this where there isn't another union wanting to represent these people, why is it best to allow the minority union to continue to be the collective bargaining representative?
I think that that is very clear from the NMB's...
But I want some common sense.
Well, this is the NMB's common sense.
What is common sense?
And if you look at why the NMB got rid of the idea of extinguishing certifications, and that's what happened. Back when, before 1987, between 1980 and 1987, the NMB said that once there was a merger, then the certifications were extinguished. That's exactly the way that the defendants in this case operated. And what the NMB found is that that was not working. And it was not working because carriers were basically choosing between the two unions, if there were two unions, or deciding whether or not to have a union. That's what happened during those years, those 7 years
well,
between 1980 and 1987.
The company can't determine whether or not there's going to be a union, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, why are they not, and is anybody trying to organize those not represented by a union?
That's very possible, Your Honor. And when that happens, there will be a petition. Because no certification can be either extended nor could a competing union seek to represent the frontier mechanics.
You haven't persuaded me it makes any sense.
So then in terms of this perpetuity, things would only change if another union organized. Otherwise, things would
just remain
the
same. If there were an initiative between the employees, which
right.
is what Section 2.9 says.
What is wrong with my suggestion? The company would not be allowed to act unilaterally because we would enjoin it from making any changes until the National Mediation Board acted. It would just be a mechanism for getting the issue to the National Mediation Board. And nothing would change until they decided, yeah, this is an illegal union. This is an illegal representation.
This court is not employees or unions. The parties that are allowed to send
an issue to the
NMB.
Where is it written that we could not issue that kind of injunction?
Section 2.9 of the Railway Labor Act, Your Honor. That section says that a representation dispute is to be resolved by the NMB,
and it is to be an application by the party. Yes. And what we would say would be, if we did this, we would say we're going to prevent the company from decertifying the union, provided that you'll make an application to the NMB, and meanwhile we will, maintain the status quo. What's wrong with that?
Your Honor, it has to be a party to the dispute. That is,
You're a party. We're saying, look, you want to continue your certification. Now you look like a minority union. You'll have to go to the board and get their ruling. Otherwise, we'll let the company do it at once.
Your Honor, I think that would be similar to the NMB's policy between 1987 and 1994.
It would. What's wrong with that? It was a good policy.
It was overturned by the RLEA case because the NMB was not an employee group or employees.
Yeah, but that didn't deal with this paralysis situation. Your position is basically ridiculous because you're saying until another union wants to organize these workers, you can have an illegal, you can be the illegal representative of these Teamsters, of these mechanics, and nobody can do anything about it. Now, the law may be so asinine that this is the situation.
The problem is that if other parties besides employees decide who is to represent the group, then you will have a situation where carriers are calling the shots as they did.
No, you're not following me. I'm saying the carrier cannot call the shot. All it can do is force you to ask the NMB for a ruling. Why is that such a hardship for you?
Because, Your Honor, the carrier is not allowed to participate in the decision.
That's a conclusion. They're not participating.
No, I think
they're just saying, look, this is a dispute. Their position is more than colorable, and there has to be a mechanism for getting it to the dispute resolution body, which is the board. What could be more straightforward?
The issue is that other party can just create a good faith doubt.
You keep saying that,
and
that's not what we're talking about. The company would be, under my suggestion, would be not doing nothing unilaterally. It would do nothing until and unless the board ruled in its favor. So there's no unilateral action by a company. So what's wrong with that?
Your Honor, I think what you see here is that the company has basically applied, what you're saying is the company should be allowed to indirectly apply
to
the NMB.
You are not following me. The company wouldn't be doing anything directly or indirectly. We would be saying, look, this is a dispute. It has to go to the board. and you go to the board, and meanwhile, nothing will change. So there'll be absolutely no change in the in your representation until the board rules.
In the Alitalia case,
your argument is that the board shouldn't be permitted to determine that your representation is illegal, which is not an attractive position.
Well, I think that there are many situations in which an employer would like to say, we don't think the union represents a minority. And
well,
and unfortunately,
of course, in this case, and you could say, well, they have to make a strong showing, which they have done.
But that
it's quite likely that your representation is illegal, and there ought to be a way of determining that and making whatever corrective action is necessary.
The
notion that you control the right to determine whether your behavior is illegal, you're the judge in your own case, that's not attractive.
Well, I think it is not myself, Your Honor, but I think what the law has said is that the prior certification...
There are two ways in which to characterize your position. Number one, you believe this is a legal union, and you believe a legal representation, and you believe that you should make the judgment that it's legal. That's one way. The other possibility is you know it's illegal, but you also know or think that you can block the board from ever determining its illegality. You refuse to allow the neutral arbiter, the board, to make the determination whether your representation is legal or not.
I want to say...
That's your bottom line.
The bottom line is that employees decide whether there is a dispute. That's what Burlington says. That's what this court has said.
Yes, exactly. The union, is going to decide for itself whether its representation is legal. Right? You're going to make the legal determination. You're going to prevent the board from disagreeing with you. That's your position.
Your Honor, I think that if you look at the Seventh Circuit precedent,
That's your position, whatever the Seventh Circuit has said, or any other court. That's your position. You decide whether the NMB shall be permitted to determine whether your position is legally sound.
Your Honor, I am citing what I believe the second.
Acknowledge that's your position, and then you can say, well, in the Seventh Circuit has accepted your position.
What I was going to say is that Section 2(9) provides that employees, not myself, not a specific union, but any group of employees can apply to the NMB to resolve an issue.
I mean, your bottom line is that we don't have the authority, right, to come up with the solution that Judge Posner said. I mean, you're just looking at that provision, reading it straight up, saying there's not another union making a request. And so you're not here to give us a sort of a reasonable way to get out of this.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't matter how many times he keeps pressing you, you're going to go right back to that section.
And that section says that's how it's done.
Right, exactly. You don't want to go to Congress and street.
Right, because that's the other alternative.
That would be
right.
Somebody else, Your Honor, that would do that rather than myself.
That's where you need to run and hide. Congress. I'm just trying to enforce the statute.
That is what I've been trying to say, but Judge Posner hasn't really wanted to hear that, and I have tried to respond to that.
As Judge Posner indicated, there's nothing that mm-hmm. prohibits.
Right.
I mean, that's the other side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
Prohibits the kind of solution he suggested.
I think that it does. I will say, although I don't think it's the most relevant issue here, in this case, the union saw the issue as a transfer of work issue because an employer is not involved in a representation issue. The employer cannot meet and confer on representation. The union saw it as a work transfer mm-hmm. issue, and the union did everything it could to address the issue of work transfer. It filed grievances.
You got a preliminary injunction. Now, preliminary injunctions, all injunctions, is governed by equitable principles. Why can't we just say it's inequitable to grant a preliminary injunction when the effect is to perpetuate an illegality?
Mm-hmm. It's not an illegality.
Maybe there's a good chance that it is.
The statute says that only...
The statute says that a minority union is not a lawful representative. And you go running into court, you're not content with all the remedies created, you know, all the administrative remedies and arbitral and mediation, all this stuff in the Railway Labor Act. You run into court, you ask an injunction. And why doesn't the judge say, I'm not going to give you an injunction because you want that injunction so that you can keep the National Mediation Board from ruling that you're an illegal representative?
What the NMB says and what the law says is that a certification continues until such time...
Do you think the law abolishes the principles of equity that govern the granting of injunctions? Remember, in technical, you know, legal theory, an injunction is always a discretionary decision by a judge weighing the equities to grant what's regarded as extraordinary relief. And how is it equitable to grant a preliminary injunction, the only purpose of which is to keep the National Mediation Board from deciding whether your union is really the legal representative of these mechanics?
Your Honor, the purpose of the injunction was to maintain
a possibly illegal status quo.
Was to
maintain it so that the National Mediation Board can't decide whether it is legal.
It was to prevent an abrogation of a collective bargaining agreement.
The court could say, I'm going to deny the preliminary injunction because it's inequitable, but I am not going to permit the company to alter the status quo until the board makes its decision as to whether this is legal representation. What's wrong with that? Why isn't that within the power of a court of equity?
The court in equity would not be considering that the employer has a right to get involved in the representation dispute. The issue between the union and the employer was the transfer of work. The union tried very hard to address that issue with the employer, did it repeatedly, and this case was only filed when the employer said, we're just going to go ahead and ignore the contract and move the work. And the Seventh Circuit in Gateway and in Burlington...
So both sides are being inequitable. You want to perpetuate an illegal situation, and they want to disrupt the union, right? All right, well, can't the district court work that out?
With all respect, Your Honor, I believe that the court is not, or that you are not reading the entire section 2nd, 9th, which is not just the issue of how the NMB goes about its job. It is who calls the question and goes to the NMB. You can't separate those two. Those are both part of the issue.
Fine, but if you want a preliminary... why doesn't the district court say, well, I'm not going to do anything? I'm not going to get involved in this. No labor injunctions.
Because it's a major dispute. The removal of work to a subsidiary, an abrogation of the contract, not because you have the right to do it, but because your position is throughout, and that has been the employer's position throughout, we don't have to recognize your contract. At that point, there is a major dispute. And I think if you look at Gateway was a merger and acquisition case. And this court in Gateway...
Well, okay, it's a major dispute, so it's enjoinable. So why can't the district court say, all right, I'm going to enjoin the company not recognizing the union, but at the same time, in order to make this an equitable decree, I'm going to say, in exchange for that relief, the union has to go to the National Mediation Board.
Well, I think
get this thing resolved. Why wouldn't that be a proper exercise of equity jurisdiction?
Because Nobody asked it because that's not what the statute allows, because even the defendants understood that the statute did not allow that.
The statute doesn't discuss preliminary injunctions.
The statute addresses who can bring a case to the NMB. And the NMB at a certain point in time tried to change that, and what the NMB found was that that did not work. And then the D.C. Circuit, looking at the statute, said that is absolutely not what is provided for. You cannot have either a forum such as the NMB or the employer calling the question. It has to be employees or their organization that calls the question. And that is a very simple concept. It applies. What defendants say is somehow merger and acquisition is separate from everything else. But that's not the way the statute reads. The statute doesn't say, P.S., other people can call the question if it's a merger and acquisition. No. Merger and acquisition is just one of a myriad of things that could change the union status at any given time. The way the statute deals with it.
Let me just ask you this. Let's step back from your individual case because we know what your position is here. But if we were to rule the way Judge Posner has suggested, what would be the policy reasons why you would say that is not a good idea? You know, I mean, step back from your individual. I mean, what would be the implications of it? Can you tell us there would be any bad implications?
Yes.
What would they be?
The implication would be that any time a employer wanted to get a different result at a given time in terms of representation, they would simply ignore a collective bargaining agreement. In this case, it may be because of a merger and acquisition. In another case, it may be a petition of employees. In another case, it may be that the employer has provided more preferable treatment to a certain group of people in the hopes that that would encourage people not to support the union. There could be all kinds of reasons that an employer could create some kind of doubt about union representation. It could be as simple as there aren't as many people who are paying dues, and the employer sees that. And then the employer just says, well, I'm not going to follow the contract.
But in those situations you've described, we don't have that gap situation or the sort of the black hole situation we
here,
do we?
If you would go with Mr. Kant's black hole situation, which is, again, there's no, in Section 7, Second 9th, there is no P.S., this doesn't apply in merger and acquisitions. What you would have is all kinds of cases, and of course not all mergers and acquisitions are the same either. Someone could buy a little trackage right or something like that, and all of a sudden they say, well, you know, we have a doubt as to majority representation. Now, we don't have a right to do that. We will simply not follow the contract. The union will have to get an injunction. They'll go to court. The court will send them to the NMB whenever we want them to be sent to the NMB. And actually, the interesting thing is that there was an experiment on exactly that policy issue. It happened between 1980 and 1987, and we've provided the case where the NMB says this isn't working. The employers are choosing
who to represent. That's different. That's where the board, that's where the company is applies directly the National Mediation Board. That's not this situation.
No, the situation between 80 and 87 was that
They're not doing that. They're not asking for the right to apply to the National Mediation Board. They have a legal position that they're not required to recognize this union. It's illegal to recognize it because it's a minority union, right? That's their position.
Your Honor.
And you go and ask for an injunction to prevent them from acting on their legal view, right? You ask for this extraordinary relief. So it's not the old NMB rule.
No, the old NMB rule was that the collective bargaining agreement, the certification, was extinguished. That's exactly the way the defendants operated here. That's what happened between 80 and 87. And in 87, the NMB said, That's not working. The employers are choosing who represents the employees. They're choosing whether or not the employees have representatives. But they did that.
You're missing the point. The company can always take the position that the collective bargaining agreement is illegal, invalid, what have you. Then you go to court and you get an injunction. And the question is, what are the terms of the injunction? That's what we're talking about.
But, Your Honor, you would just foment a lot of situations in which an employer would have an incentive not to follow the collective bargaining agreement. The RLA is all about stability.
Not to follow it in any case where he has a strong legal argument that it's not a valid agreement, right?
Your Honor, that would destabilize the transportation industry.
That's very melodramatic characterization of this problem.
Well, I think it's very accurate. If the employer started not following collective bargaining agreements to force unions into court to get injunctions and cases of all kinds went to the NMB, you would have a very chaotic situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Robbins. And Mr. Quant, does he have any time left?
The parade of horrors that counsel described and the chaos, the NMB didn't find any of that. They were perfectly content with continuing with their policy. The unions, the railroad unions and RLEA, they got an association together and they went to court in the Second Circuit. That's what led to the decision. And it's the court that brought up a couple of potential problems associated with this, none of which have to do with anything counsel has identified. One of the problems they identified was that you could even have a passenger who, is, the minute there was a merger of two airlines, was concerned this would affect his flight in the upcoming months or whatnot, and he might run off the NMB. There's no evidence in the record that any of these parade of horrors the counsel described happened under the policy that existed between 87 and 94. I'd make that point.
The policy was opposed by?
It was opposed by the Second Circuit, which required the NMB to change their policy.
What segment of the industry opposed the
rail
policy?
But it's the same issue, Your Honor. This issue, the big issue that's come up.
Railroads that opposed
railroad,
them?
Yes, Your Honor. This issue just came up with Delta Airlines. They have the exact same issue.
Because Ms. Robbins was suggesting that the old NMB rule was harmful to unions.
There's no evidence of that. None. And she can't cite any. There's certainly none in the record. There's none in the RLEA decision. No record of any of that. The Delta case is interesting, Your Honor. I'll stop after this. But what's happened at Delta is the exact same situation that we're facing. Delta, of course, is primarily a non-union airline. They acquire Northwest, which is primarily a union airline. Delta's bigger than Northwest slightly, not much. Well, they have the same situation. They could not force the flight attendants, the mechanics are a different category, the flight attendants, the ground people, the passenger service people, to file applications to clarify whether or not there was a legal, bona fide union on the property. And it was an impasse. There's a case going on right now in the D.C. Circuit involving these same issues. And Delta was trying to figure out how can we force the issue, just like we're trying to do the same thing. Curiously, what has happened in that case, the voting rule was changed under the Railway Labor Act, where the unions were successful in getting the NMB to change the voting procedures, where now it's determined the outcome of elections are determined on the basis of a majority of the people that actually vote, as opposed to the majority of the eligible class or craft, mm-hmm. opposed by management, opposed by Delta, but it was adopted by the NMB. Immediately thereafter, the unions finally did go forward and file their applications for single carrier. There are now elections pending with the flight attendants, with the ground people, with the dispatchers, a whole group of different people. The flight attendant election is going to be announced next Thursday. So the point is, when unions saw that it was their benefit, that they had a chance of winning the election, they went ahead and filed these petitions. The ridiculous situation right now is, when they know they don't have a chance of winning the election, they can throw these obstacles into a rational integration of the operation of my client, and it's cost my client a lot of money. And we think there needs to be a solution.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Quine. Thank you to both counsel.